Our podcast staff is very grateful to Crane and Gray, the excellent website design people who've put together our website and have done wonderfully well with it. Oswald Spengler is well known as the author of the book, The Decline of the West. I've always loved the German title, Der Untergang des Abendlandes, The Going Down of the Evening Land. A reincarnation of Spengler, a reincarnation of a sort, is with us at the moment, namely a very well-established and really quite important writer with regard to the history of civilization, and more particularly with regard to our civilization and the one that closely challenges it, namely Islam. That guest is David Goldman. It's hard to describe you, David Goldman. You have, of course, been a banker at a very high level. You were one of the editors of First Things, a very important journal, and you write regularly for all sorts of other publications. And you are, as I said, Spengler. Maybe you had better explain why and how that came to be.
I wrote a column for Asia Times, which started as a humor column, and we thought it was amusing to have an Asian newspaper feature a column about the West with a byline of the fellow who wrote the book Decline of the West. It started as a pure joke. The original Spengler, although a very clever fellow with many important insights, was a nasty piece of work, a racist, and something of a biological determinist. So I distanced myself sharply from many of the original Spengler's ideas.
Well, you call him a racist. He was just a racist in the standard Middle European mode. He was anti-Semitic. He had nothing against the Chinese, as far as I know.
Yes, but I have nothing against the Chinese either. But being Jewish, I certainly don't consider myself anti-Semitic, and that's something I should surely distance myself from.
Yet his book was of great influence. The title is just a superb one, and it really gives you something to catch on as you're sort of wallowing in the disorders, the confusions, maybe even the occasional despairs of your time and your place. So that for many years he was quoted as someone really with a special, sharp focus on our ultimate fate, our fate being the fate of the Western world or of Western civilization.
The one point that Oswald Spengler nailed was that as we move from traditional society, where people have children as a matter of habit and duty, to modern society, where people have children as a matter of personal fulfillment, we would suffer a drastic decline in fertility and ultimately population decline. In that sense, he was prophetic, because in most of the Western world, the shift from traditional society has led to fertility rates so low that they challenge the viability at a 100-year horizon of some of the most important nations in the world. Italy, Germany, Spain, Japan, and so forth.
We've had many comments along those lines in recent years, many books which really have posted and posed the problem. The one I think of immediately is America Alone by...
By Mark Stein,
in which he speaks of a great demographic crisis which is upon us and has been with us for some time, noting quite simply that the birth rates in all of Western Europe are such that there is more death than birth. 2.1 births per woman is considered to be sort of the replacement, the minimum replacement level to maintain your population. And it's very, very much lower in many European countries, as low, I believe, as 1.4 in Italy, 1.6 or thereabouts in France. And only in the United States do we barely make replacement level at around 2.1.
Here's a factoid. At a fertility rate of 1.3 children per female in 200 years, the German population will decline by 98%. The champion on the downside is Hungary, whose ethnic Hungarian or Magyar population has a fertility rate of only about 0.85, fewer than one child per female on average, which is a death sentence. And the question is...
I think it's all that paprikush that somehow inhibits sexuality.
Well, the Hungarians, for whatever reason, seem to be extremely depressed. But this is a phenomenon that we've never seen on a global scale with such intensity, but we have seen it many times in individual societies where we have, if not a great deal of statistical data, comprehensive anecdotal data, and probably the first one is Hellenistic Greece after the Alexandrian conquests, where the population shrank really due to female infanticide and lack of interest in raising female children, to the point that the Greeks couldn't field a dozen regiments of phalanx men to challenge the Romans when they walked in.
By the way, is it possibly the case in this country, in the United States, that though we still meet replacement level, that is through the assistance or through the strong contribution of recent immigrants, most particularly Hispanic immigrants? If you go to the sort of native Caucasian population of the United States, don't you now get, in fact, a birth rate somewhat below replacement level?
That's exactly correct. In fact, the last census data show a drop in American fertility to only 1.9 per female, which is well below the replacement level of 2.1, and that's entirely attributable to a sharp decline in fertility among Hispanic women. It appears that Hispanic Catholics, when they come to the United States, initially have the same high fertility rate they did at home, but that as they become acculturated, their fertility rate also declines to more like American levels.
Some have argued that the basic nature of that relationship across history, across time and space, is that affluence is negatively correlated with birth.
That, it is, but it's more complicated.
Yeah, well, I know it is, or I assume it is, and I'm looking for the complications. Well, but it isn't simply a matter of the more money you've got, the less you breed.
The one great exception to that is worth focusing on, even though it's small, and that's the state of Israel, which has an overall fertility rate of 3.0, which is by far the highest in the industrial world. And excluding the ultra-Orthodox, who famously have very large families, the fertility rate among Jewish Israelis is still 2.6. So there are significant exceptions. The Israeli demographics are closest to that in population of American evangelical Christians, who also have a fertility rate in the mid-2s. What we find is that people who belong to strong religious communities or communities with a strong sense of historical identity, many secular Israelis have a degree of religiosity which is extremely hard to measure, but nonetheless, to be an Israeli is to have a strong commitment to an historical community. Such people tend to have large numbers of children. Secular people tend to have much smaller numbers of children. There's a very strong correlation that's been brought out by a number of studies in the late 2000s, which show this in a way that I think really can be considered as close to statistical proof as you could come, particularly some work done at the Max Planck Institute. My friend Mary Eberstadt,
she's one of our leading demographers, in fact, isn't she?
Yeah, Mary is a terrific writer. I just reviewed a new book she wrote called How the West Really Lost God at Claremont Review, in which she reviews this data. I reviewed some of this data also in my book How Civilizations Die. And I think there are two important things here, Milt. One is affluence and the lack of the economic pressure to have children as cheap farm labor and as, in fact, a social security system. And the second reason is secularization. People of faith all around the world have large numbers of children. The main difference between the United States and Israel and Europe is that you've got a lot more people of faith in Israel and the United States.
Now, you say people of faith. People of faith have more children. Is that any faith, or is it particularly Judeo-Christian Islamic faith?
I think it's true generally, but we've got no real way of measuring it, say, in China or Japan, where it's not really clear what faith is. It's difficult to understand.
A curious and anomalous finding, and indeed demographic statistic which really hits you in the face, it's just so extreme, is the low birth rate in Japan, where no one seems to be interested in having kids anymore.
And South Korea.
And South Korea as well. Well, what are we to make of that? Those are conventionally and traditionally Buddhist societies. There should be a fair amount of religiosity still going around.
Well, I don't think these are remotely religious societies. I think Zen Buddhism is mainly a tourist thing, including internal tourism to Japan. And Shinto, which was developed under the Meiji Restoration of the 19th century as a nationalistic religion.
Yeah, well, that's a patriotic cult, essentially.
This Shinto was basically destroyed by the loss of the Second World War. I think Japanese culture has gone through one of the great disruptions that a culture possibly can go through, despite the fact that the emperor was kept in place by the American occupiers. The sense of a discontinuity, the loss of the past and loss of tradition in Japan is stunningly evident in Japanese society.
Well, look, we've now reached a point where, in a sense, we've got a generalization that we can travel with. It is that, essentially, religiosity fosters fecundity. If that is so, we need then to explain the nature of that relationship. Why does religiosity lead to simply a greater interest in and greater performance in reproducing in kind?
In Jewish and Christian societies, having children is a fundamental religious responsibility. Both religious Jews and religious Christians believe that family life and having children is the ideal way to live as a religious person. I think it's more than a matter of accepting doctrinal instruction. I think that the sense of continuity of culture, of having a heritage and a sense of life beyond one's mortal existence, gives you the motivation to wish to pass this on to one's children. It's particularly strong with the Jews, for whom children represent the continuity of life, just as we represent the continuity of our ancestors' lives. But I think it's a very similar sentiment is powerful with Christians as well. In the case of Islam, it's extremely difficult to measure, because Islam, in a sense, has gone from infancy to senility without ever passing through adulthood. What we've seen demographically in Muslim countries, which have gone through basically a serious literacy campaign, and Iran, Turkey, Algeria, Tunisia would be the great examples, is that birth rates have fallen from the highest in the world to the lowest in the world, or some of the lowest in the world, within a single generation. That's a stunning development. Never happened before in history. You've never had such a fast decline of fertility in any society in the world, Iran being the extreme example.
Now, this is rather curious. We mentioned Mark Stein earlier. The prediction, the morose prediction in Stein's book, the first one, America Alone, America will be alone because all the rest of Western civilization of what was once Christendom will have been taken over by Islam. That because of the very low rate of Caucasian birth and the very high rate of Islamic birth, including those Muslims who are now resident in or will be crowding into Europe. So that even now you see city councils, Amsterdam is one, or is it Rotterdam, where the majority membership is Islamic. And in general, the numbers keep rising. And in the banlieue of Paris, we have a whole separate Islam, as we have also scattered all over England, where the restiveness of Islam is often experienced by local bombings and so on. The picture that Stein gives is that Islam is coming on because we, the Western Caucasian populations particularly, have abandoned the ambition to reproduce in kind and keep our civilization going.
Well, in many cases, Muslim countries are just one step behind us. In other cases, where Muslim countries remain locked in traditional society with a very low literacy rate, fertility remains extremely high. There's a nearly perfect correlation between fertility rates and the levels of literacy, particularly female literacy, in Muslim countries. So Pakistan still has 4 children per female, with a 50% literacy rate. And a country like England, which mainly has Pakistani immigrants, is having a disproportionate population increase on the part of Pakistanis. And from an English standpoint, one could indeed get the impression that Mark Stein reported. From the German standpoint, though, where it's not Pakistanis but Turks, have overall fertility rate, Turkish speakers, not including Kurds, that's well below replacement. The Turks tend to acculturate relatively quickly and fall to European-style fertility levels. Germany is in no danger of being taken over by Turkish immigrants. So it's a very deeply variegated picture, depending on how fast the democratic transition has hit the particular group of Muslims who happen to be immigrating to or reproducing in a particular country.
You know, if religion is positively correlated with birth level, and if literacy and education is inversely or negatively correlated, a particularly odd instance is in Palestine, that is, among the Palestinian population, where the women tend to be, I think, they are religious, sufficiently Islamic in their faith, and they tend to be more fully educated, or at least they are more literate, yet their birth rate, I think, runs something like close to 3.5 per family.
It's actually fallen to 3.
It's down to 3 now.
The Jewish and Arab birth rates in the entire area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea have converged on 3. So projecting that forward, there is going to be very little change in the relative demographics of Jews and Arabs in that part of the world, contrary to the often repeated shibboleth about a democratic time bomb. Exactly how religious Muslims are in different countries is extremely hard to measure on the basis of polling data. The Iranians are probably the least religious Muslims in the world if you look at such figures as mosque attendants.
And the most strongly suppressed by a theocratic state.
Absolutely. I think once that evil regime eventually collapses, as one day it must, we'll find that Iran is comparable to the Soviet Union, where there really weren't any communists except for members of the Central Committee.
Now, I've got an argument for you, or at least I got a contradiction that someone has put forward, not me, but I'm reading. The title of your book, of course, is How Civilizations Die, Paren, and Why Islam is Dying Too. And you say that in general, the birth rate is going down in Islam. But somebody, and I'm not even clear who he is, I guess he doesn't give his name, asserts that you're a great and very fascinating theorist and he loves your work, but he disagrees about the birth rates in the various Muslim countries. And he presents the following data. It is true, Iran has the lowest birth rate. It's 1.87, below replacement level. But the birth rates for the rest are Indonesia, 2.23. That is, this is not birth rate. It's the ratio between birth and death, of course. And 2.1 represents replacement level. And anything higher is still more full replacement. So Indonesia, 2.23. Pakistan, 3.07. Bangladesh, 2.55. Egypt, 2.94. Iran, 1.87. Turkey, 2.13. Algeria, 2.78. Morocco, 2.19. Iraq, very high, 3.58. Sudan, 4.17. Just about the highest, except for the last, which is Afghanistan, at 5.64. Do those data contradict yours?
Not in the least, because the trend has been rapidly downwards. You have a lot of Muslim countries which are still above replacement. Some of those individual numbers are wrong, but there's nothing wrong with the overall picture they tell. The point is they've come down from levels of 6 and 8 just a generation ago. Iran's gone down to not 1.8, but really closer to 1.5, 1.6. And Algeria is well below replacement. Turkey, excluding the Kurds, is about 1.5, 1.6, depending on how you measure the Kurds. So you have some extreme demographic problems, which are widely recognized in those countries themselves. In other places, well, take the West Bank that you just mentioned. Yes, the Palestinian Arabs have a fertility rate of 3, but 20 years ago it was 6. the trend has been the fastest decline in fertility measured anywhere in history, pretty much across the Muslim world.
Now, let us talk about the very beginning of Der Untergang des Abendlandes, the decline of the West. That may well have been the fall of Rome, though Rome was a vast and successful operation that lasted for close to 1,000 years, if you count the Republic and then the Empire. From that point to the present, has demography been the key to civilizational decline?
I think the will to live has been the key to civilizational decline, mm-hmm. and a fail-safe hallmark of the lack of will to live is failure to raise children. Confident and happy civilizations have lots of children, and depressed and despairing civilizations have few children.
But we know there's also a relation between affluence and number of children. That suggests that affluent societies become unhappy.
Well, I don't think this is necessarily the case. Israel is a very affluent place, and affluent people in Israel have lots of children. Affluent American evangelicals and affluent American modern Orthodox Jews have lots of children. I think you can separate the great fertility transition, as demographers call it, into two vectors, so to speak. In traditional society, the minimum number of live births per female you needed to overcome high mortality and so forth and maintain the existing population was about 5. On top of that, there was no contraception. Children were cheap farm labor. They were desirable economically. There were many reasons to have children. People didn't think about it. It was simply what they did. Modern society gives people a choice. In most of the modern world, people made the choice to stop having children because they no longer had to. The exceptions to that, including very affluent exceptions, were people of faith who survived the great secularization. So another way to formulate the question is, can we expect faith to survive the modern secular world? There are many people who don't think so at all. They think that religious faith is a fossil of a traditional society which has to wither away under the bright light of modernity. Clearly, I don't believe that. I'm a modern Orthodox Jew myself. But if those people are right, that faith is going to become an odd little niche practiced by a few surviving fanatics like myself, then we will have demographic catastrophe.
Well, we have cultural leaders, or at least intellectoid journalists of a high reputation, who've been spending a lot of time pushing the new atheism. One knows the roster. The English physicist, what's his name?
Dawkins. Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins.
Both of them, in fact,
Hawkins,
yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah. And the recently deceased international journalist of great reputation.
Christopher Hitchens.
Christopher Hitchens. And David Dennett, a philosopher. All of them have done their books about why there's no God and why thinking that there might be is really deleterious to the maintenance of your highest level of human sensibility.
Clearly, I disagree with that, and on different topics, I've written a few things about that in First Things. There tend to be more academic articles, but I think a very good case could be made that science and theology were joined at the hip in some of the greatest periods of intellectual discovery, and that religion needs make no apology at all to science. But that's a different issue.
Another related issue, and this brings us to something which preoccupies just about everybody who's going to pick up and read your book, is the assertion that a great civilizational conflict has erupted in the world, and it is between the remnant of Christendom, one would have to say, and Islam. Sam Huntington of Harvard did his book about the clash of civilizations, and he predicted, he died some 10 years ago now, but he predicted two great clashes were coming, one between the West and the East, meaning China, essentially, but preceding that is a great conflict that is already visible between the West and Islam coming on strong, as if it's renewing the kind of invasion of Europe that we suffered in the 9th and 10th centuries. What you're adding to this is, yes, there may be a civilizational conflict, but both of those civilizations are in their death throes, though they don't know it.
I think Europe and Islam are both in extreme decline. What we saw in Egypt, for example, in the last 48 hours is illustrative. Supposedly, political Islam was the wave of the future, taking over the Middle East, triumphant and unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And then we saw 14 million Egyptians in the streets, not only denouncing political Islam, but denouncing the President of the United States for being sympathetic to it.
But those are the same Egyptians who only a year ago voted the Muslim Brotherhood government in.
I think that's because they really didn't know what they wanted, and a lot of 45% of them are illiterate, and most of them have no experience at all with the democracy, and have no real understanding of what it means. But what they do know is that they're hungry. They don't have enough to eat, and they're hoping the military, which used to feed them, will feed them again. The collapse of the most important Islamist government to take power since Khomeini in 1979, after less than a year in power, I think is a demonstration that Islamic civilization, if we think of it as a union of state and church and Islam with aggressive ambitions, is an extremely fragile animal.
If that fragile, how does one account for their murderous assault upon the West and upon Western institutions? How does one account for Al-Qaeda and its many works in evil ways? And how does one account for the stories that show up almost every day in the international press of some sort of direct assault by Muslims, fanatic Muslims, to be sure, denounced by lots of other Muslims, but some assault by fanatic Muslims against essentially Christians or, of course, Jews?
Terrorism is the weapon of the weak. If the United States decided to use even a fraction of its military power to punish states that encourage terrorism, for example, Iran, which I believe is a state sponsor of terrorism, and it represents a significant danger in development of nuclear weapons, we could swat them in a day. The American Air Force could take them out with a couple of thousand sorties, to the point there'd be nothing left of their military, and if we wish, nothing left of their economy. That's a matter of will. With a billion and a quarter Muslims, of whom, say, 700 or 800 million are at serious risk, exclude the Malaysians, the Indonesians seem to be doing okay, and they're not really that aggressive. But nearly a billion people are at risk if only 2% or 5% of them decide to take the rest of us down with them, the consequences could be horrifying. But I think it's certainly within our power to defend ourselves against this. The biggest problem is we've chosen in many cases not to. I think it's scandalous that Iran has been allowed to progress this far in developing nuclear weapons. I'm an interventionist. I think we should use military action to prevent the Iranians from acquiring nuclear weapons. And should we do that, there's nothing they could do.
Focus for a moment on a central figure until his demise, Osama bin Laden. Was he secretly aware that Islam is in decay and is in its death throes, and just making a last gesture of rage against a competing civilization? Or was he indeed a believer in what he said he believed, namely the inevitability of the establishment of the Ummah, that is, the worldwide Islamic community?
I think that this, again, there are two vectors to the thinking of the Islamist. If you read the writings of Qutb, the Egyptian who founded political Islam in the 1950s, the chief theorist of the Muslim Brotherhood and the inspiration for bin Laden and others, he says there's not a single Muslim country left. We've all been corrupted. The colonialists have destroyed Islam, and we need to recreate it almost from scratch. And, of course, if we do that, then, of course, Allah will look at us kindly, and we cannot fail but conquer the world with God's help. So I think there's both an element of despair and triumphalism in the thinking of Islamists, but the motivating factor for political Islam as a movement from the 1950s onward is the sense that modernity is destroying Islam. And I think that perception in large respects was justified.
One commentator on modern Islam and its troubles, whom I know you've read rather closely, was Bernard Lewis. Indeed, I've chatted with him a few times on the air, and I'm always very impressed by him. He's now, I believe, in his mid-90s and is still holding forth at Princeton in some role or other. What is the Bernard Lewis understanding of what went wrong in Islam?
Bernard Lewis makes the point eloquently and thoroughly that by the late 18th century, early 19th century, the Islamic world began to understand that it was losing. It had been in the past richer, more powerful, better educated than the West, and sometime between the failure of the siege of Vienna in 1683 and the French occupation of Egypt under Napoleon, the Islamic world came to understand that they'd been overtaken. They didn't have the technology, they didn't have the science, they didn't have the military power, and they were losing. So he diagnoses Muslim rage as the response of a former imperial power to its impotence in the face of an adversary that's overtaken.
Is that a credible hypothesis?
I think he's exactly right. Professor Lewis has been, shall we say, a bit more optimistic about the prospects for reform and modernization in the Muslim world than I am. My perception is that as the moment you try to apply solutions which should lead Muslim countries into modernity, such as educating women, the result is a cultural shift which leads to disastrous consequences, such as they simply stop having children. So I don't think Muslim countries are going to make it as civilizations. I think we're going to see a long and unpleasant slide into decline. But in terms of diagnosis, I've learned a great deal from Professor Lewis, and I honor his work.
As one looks toward the future and tries to find some basis for prediction, what you come out with essentially is that the two bastions of Western civilization in terms of vigor and inventiveness and perhaps even in terms of economic prosperity are the vast nation of the United States and the very small New Jersey-sized nation of Israel. Are Israel and the United States the key to the survival or renewal of Western civilization?
Well, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot going on elsewhere. For example, if you look at the figure of Pope Benedict the 16th, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he gave up, perhaps
out of sheer despair. I don't know what went on there.
Well, most of my Catholic friends have diagnosed this publicly as a failed papacy. And as a Jew, looking sympathetically at the institutions of the West, including the Catholic Church, and wishing them success, I can't help but be discouraged by the fact that one of the greatest Catholic minds of the past couple of generations appears to have failed as a pope. So the hope of reversing the secularization of Europe and its slide into cultural anomie doesn't seem to be very convincing. On the other hand, who knows what might happen in other parts of the world? China is open territory. 110 million Chinese, according to Chinese government numbers, now consider themselves to be Christians. China, in some respects, is absorbing Western culture faster than anyone else. That most uniquely Western art form, classical music, is more honored by the Chinese than in any other country. There are 40 million classical music students in China. So it's possible that Western culture, just as it was transferred from the Greeks to the Romans and the Romans to the Teutonic tribes and the English and to us, might still be transferred from the Europeans to people in Asia or Africa or elsewhere. So I'm not hopeless about this. I think Western culture has an enormous attraction, an appeal to the human spirit, which no other culture in the world offers. And so I'm hopeful that it may well survive by adoption in other parts of the world. And I'm very hopeful about the United States.
We've said in this conversation very little about economics and about national productivity and general prosperity. How does all of that relate to what we've been talking about?
Well, ultimately, you can't have a viable economy without viable demographics, because the burden of caring for dependent elderly will become so gross that the tax on the few remaining workers will be oppressive enough to crush the economy. That's the great problem that Europe and Japan face going forward. In the United States, we still have an expanding workforce, even though our fertility rate has declined and maybe the result of the recession. It's hard to know whether this is a real trend, but we still have an expanding workforce going out to 2050, even though we will have an increase in the elderly-dependent ratio. It's not something that can't be handled. But certainly, over the long term, economics and sound demographics are inseparable.
An interesting finding, popularized by George Gilder in a book of a few years ago, is that when you examine the nations of the world in terms of what they contribute to the digital technological culture, in terms of invention, in terms of production, in terms of, in general, moving the frontier forward, two nations lead all the rest. And they are indeed the two nations whom you favor in this book, the United States, no surprise there, and Israel, rather a surprise there. Israel is doing more in terms of digital advance than is France or Germany or the United Kingdom or what have you.
And Israel is also doing wonderfully in classical music.
Yes, I know you've got a very strong interest in music as well, and have taught musicology and related subjects. Is that true? They've got orchestras, you mean? I'm sure that's true. Well, do they have
They have a huge. They punch 10 times above their weight in competitions, in first year positions, symphony orchestras, conducting positions, and so forth. They are. The Israelis do spectacularly well. I have a conjecture about this. When we train musicians at American conservatories, we told them the way to get a career is win a competition. The way to win a competition is make the fewest mistakes. So we train risk-averse musicians who are boring. The Israelis are not risk-averse. They know how to live with risk, and they communicate that in the music, which makes them so much more fun to listen to.
Interesting. A truly interesting point. A last difficult issue. You say, to reduce and to simplify, more religion out there would serve the world well, would serve civilization well. And you really wish that people could turn back to religion if they are no longer in a religious frame of mind or in an internalized religious culture. However, you know as well as somebody who's been in the great universities and who has strong connections at the intellectoid level of our society, you know that many people who are even positively disposed towards religion, who know its value socially, cannot bring themselves to join up. They can't bring themselves to really internalize the beliefs. You say that you are, and I'm sure, and of course you're saying, you're reporting accurately that you are an Orthodox Jew. I know that you were something else earlier on. To be an Orthodox Jew might require you to really believe the more or less factual correctness of the first five books of the Old Testament. But I cannot believe that you really believe that God created the heavens and the earth in 7 days, even if you call those days, each of them, a year or a millennium or what have you.
That is to say, rabbinic tradition considers the creation story to be a moral fable as opposed to a scientific
report. Right. Well, modern thinkers who are disposed well towards religion but can't manage to really commit themselves to a serious organized religion generally think this is all fable, including the crucial story of Christianity, that it's a narrative of tremendous moving quality, but essentially it is fabulous. It is a fable.
Let the Christians defend their own point. My thought about the Bible here, Milton, is very simple. The idea that every human being is a living image of God and has inherent worth before God, such that you have to love the stranger as yourself. You can't murder or eat members of other tribes like chimpanzees. You don't hail people like Odysseus for being a sacker of cities, but men of peace. That idea didn't come about gradually. It seems to have appeared all at once. Something happened around the time we talk about the revelation of Sinai, which gave humankind an entirely different way of looking at the world. That seems to me to be the great singularity in history. I understand it as an intervention of God in history. The rest is details, and from the standpoint of being an Orthodox Jew, if God, in association with that, wants us to avoid, say, eating dogs and cats and only eat ruminants and slaughter them in a humane way, various other things, and observe Shabbat, those are things I'm perfectly happy to go along with in the package.
Yes, but theologically that isn't full Judaism, it seems to me. Just as, for example, the Catholicism of Gary Wills, and he writes a lot about his Catholicism, is more a celebration of community than it is really a serious commitment to the truth value of the narratives that undergird Christianity.
Well, I think God intervened in history. I think history contains a great singularity, the idea of Kavanah and of individual worth, which begins with the Kavanah of God and the Jewish people, which does not have to be exclusive to God and the Jewish people forever, according to our prophets, and the way God manifests his desires towards us is to ask us to do certain things which make us holy. Those are the commandments. So Judaism is the practice of mitzvot, as we understand God asked us to do those things. I don't claim to be a particularly pious Jew, but I do my best to observe.
How are you going to bring all the professors at Harvard, or for that matter at my place, the University of Chicago, how are you going to bring them back into church or synagogue?
Well,
they don't go.
My argument is that the need for something beyond our mortal existence, something beyond the way Hobbes looked at man, is so powerful that if we throw religion out, we'll end up believing in UFOs or watching zombie movies or doing something else, quote, spiritual. G.K. Chesterton is often misquoted as saying, if you don't believe in God, you believe in anything. And if you look at what people believe in out there, the popular culture, they believe in anything. They believe in the zombie apocalypse, ghosts, UFOs, angels, and so on.
Sure.
So we do have a massive religiosity out there. It's simply disorganized and often crazy. Compared to that, Orthodox Judaism or Orthodox Catholicism are relatively well-ordered, stable, and philosophically founded.
Yes, but they don't sell as well as they used to, is my point.
Well, I'm not selling. You're asking me about it. My observation and the observation of the demographic profession is that faith and fertility are joined at the hip. I think it's a fair statement that the original Oswald Spengler, to go back to your opening point, will have turned out to be correct, that we'll go through a demographic disaster if we simply go into modernism with the outlook of the Ibsen female, as he put it. That's a good enough characterization as ever. If that's the way we're going to go, then we will die out demographically, and if it's not Muslims who take over our places, it'll be sub-Saharan African Christians or someone else who do have children.
Of course, some of the great historical theorists who might be called cyclic theorists who look at the rise, the fall and rise of civilizations, argue that civilizations inevitably have a life cycle and they die and they give birth to, or they somehow assist at the birth of a new and more vigorous civilization.
I sure hope they're wrong. I like the one we've got now.
I see.
I'm not a cyclic. I don't believe in inevitable cycles. Oswald Spengler talked about a biological view with an actual life cycle of a civilization. I don't see why it has to be that way. The Jews have been around with our civilization for 3,500 years. I hope the United States of America, which has a unique civilization in terms of protecting individual liberty, will last forever.
Well, then an appropriate ending to this conversation would be from your mouth to God's ear.
It's not up to me.
If God arranges these things at all, let us hope that he's listening to us and will take heart and find purpose. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an exceptionally interesting conversation, at least from the point of this participant, and I hope you found it of some interest as well.
My privilege entirely. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks again. And with that, we'll close down for the day.